Hey everyone, I'm back with Jamie in Swiss for this exclusive segment that you are either hearing because you just bought his book or because you purchased the Daily Magician tapes. And we're going to talk about a very interesting topic. And just to preface this, we've been talking for a while now about what we should talk about. So we're excited to get into this. And this is what Jamie highlighted as something that he thought was really important to discuss. So I think
we decided that because you're paying, it's time that I reveal the secret to the Hooker Rising cards.
Yeah, it's finally coming out. Congratulations.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, you said 5 minutes? Oh, we haven't got time. No. That's a shame.
Next time. Jamie shared it with me earlier.
We'll have to do something else.
Yeah. In actuality, we're going to talk about Di Vernon. And honestly, now I feel a little bit of pressure because we've been talking about this and Jamie's like, I'm very interested to hear what you have to say. So I'm going to keep it concise and honest, hopefully, candid. Obviously, Di Vernon's a name that pretty much everyone should know. And if you don't know, that's kind of a travesty in magic. He has been talked about as having some of the most influence on magic of anyone. He's kind of a legend of our time. And I guess for myself personally, when I think of Di Vernon, there's one quote that always comes to mind that I find that I actually repeat constantly. And I think that you and I talked about before, Jamie, which is like to be an interesting magician, you need to be an interesting person. And I think that's what personally how I relate to Di Vernon. And I remember what you were saying, actually, I was listening back to the podcast yesterday about how he could hold a conversation with an extremely rich businessman and with someone on the side of the street in the exact same way, because he was able to relate to people.
Yep.
And I think personally for myself, obviously Di Vernon is a master of the art. He has a genius. I mean, actually today I was jamming on, Danny Goldsmith and I were actually jamming on one of his false shuffles where he has the cards like slightly outjogged in the box and he brings them out and then does a riffle and then lays them out and then pushes them together, and it's just genius stuff. And that's just
remind me, where is that described?
It's in one of his books. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference right now, but I'll get it for you afterwards. I feel bad now. I'll try and get it, and I'll put it maybe in the description of this audio training.
Great.
I think the reason we wanted to bring this up is because Jamie was talking about the fact that obviously Di Vernon has passed on, and also a lot of the people that he personally mentored have also passed on. And so my question to you, Jamie, is what do we not know about Di Vernon? What can we learn from Di Vernon? And who really was he? Because there's quite a contentious issue within the magic community.
Within some circles, that's true, because I see from some remote areas of magic, of voices that question Vernon's contribution, question his validity, question his meaningfulness today, his relevance today, question whether the stories attached to him were really true, or was he just making stuff up? I see a lot of these questions. Question is whether his work is contemporary and can be used in a contemporary fashion today. And this is a shame. We get, time marches on. But the way you advance in any field, I don't care if it's a science or the arts, is you stand on the shoulders of giants before you. And that was true of none more greatly than Vernon himself, who spent his life crediting others and celebrating his own mentors. Some people think Vernon didn't have mentors. He certainly had them. And he celebrated them. And he celebrated them throughout his life. In some cases, he celebrated them by writing whole books about them, like Nate Leipzig, who was a very important influence on Vernon. He was a generation older. And Vernon met him when he was quite young. And Max Mellini, who Vernon admired tremendously. And, recently I saw a lecture for Magic Castle members that Vernon gave in his late 80s at the castle that I hadn't seen before. And there he is in his 80s. Most of his contemporaries are dead and gone. And as he fluidly and brilliantly moved, really breathtakingly moved from one thing to the next, from coins to cards to cups and balls to linking rings to ropes even. He did a rope move. I'd never seen it. It killed me. And I don't even do rope magic. He would never touch anything without crediting someone. Oh, I learned this move from so-and-so was so great at this. He did this throughout his entire life. And it greatly informed his thinking. And it informed his role as a mentor. Because the underlying lesson of his mentorship was pay it forward. Johnny Thompson, my probably greatest and certainly last mentor, was notorious for this. My friend Alex Boyce, a young magician from New York, who is the finest young dove worker I know, does the best act of silent act I currently know, called up Johnny Thompson one day and said, I want to study dove magic. And he said, okay, come out to Vegas. And there was no talk of charges or arrangements or details. If he was willing to put in the effort to come to Vegas, then he must have been worthy of teaching in John's mind. And indeed, Alex Boyce became a deep student, protege of John Thompson, and it shows in his work. So anyway, more directly to your question, many people think that Vernon's greatest contribution to card magic, for example, was very advanced technique. And while he certainly did contribute to advanced technique, since, you know, he transformed sleight of hand magic for all of the 20th century with using Erdnase as his lamp to light the way, he was not limited to that. And in the realm of card magic alone, as I wrote about in an essay on my blog a couple of months ago called Vernon's Elegant Selected Card Management, I wrote about the fact that in many ways, Vernon simplified card magic and put great card magic within the reach of the average hobbyist at a time when really it was very secretive and very difficult. The example I offer is that if you were learning card magic from Hoffman's Modern Magic, which was originally an installment in a public magazine to interest young hobbyists.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So when you talk about exposure, you know, when the standard approach to handling a selected card in Hoffman's day was to control the card by the two-handed pass, palm the card off the top, hand the deck out for shuffling, take it back, secretly replace the card, and proceed from there. That's a very good procedure, but it's also very difficult. And if you wanted a card to change, a single card to change, you needed to master the top change, which is not a difficult move mechanically, but is an extremely challenging sleight when it comes to more advanced requirements like misdirection and audience management. So Vernon, when he first comes to New York for the first time, before he comes to live in New York in the 40s, the first time he comes much earlier, and he's around New York and he's fooling magicians with a double lift. Why? Because the double lift traditionally had been done in this very stiff and formal way where you grip the cards at the ends and you held it up vertically to the audience in this very kind of stiff display. That's how magicians thought you did a double lift. Double lift had been around for a long time. It was first described in 1716 in The Merry Companion by William Neave, and it was in fact applied to a brief ambitious card, what we would describe as ambitious card effect, but it was never in regular use. Well, Vernon was fooling everybody with the double lift because he had created the first of several of his double lift handlings that simulated a push-off, the one that's described in the Stars of Magic and the ambitious card routine, and magicians did not, it was so natural, magicians did not recognize that he was doing a double lift. And then he, inspired by Erdnase, he created the double undercut, a move that people sniff at today very typically. Oh, that old thing, which is in fact done properly, a really deceptive and natural looking control that you can vary in many ways. You can do it multiple packets to the table. You can, you know, give it various kinds of looks. You can use it as a full deck false cut in the hands or to the table. And it's nowhere nearly as difficult as a classic pass. And the fact of the matter is that a double undercut that deceives people is vastly preferable to a classic shift that flashes. So Vernon put great magic, the great extraordinary magic that's in The Stars of Magic, one of the two greatest books of the mid-20th century, both having a lot to do with Vernon, one being the original Stars of Magic, the other being the Vernon Book of Magic. He put these fabulous tricks in reach of an audience that otherwise could not have done it. Same way that Triumph, one of his greatest tricks, single tricks, or maybe his greatest single trick, many would say, that's what John Thompson believed, which in fact, in the real world, Vernon did with a strip-out shuffle, a pull-out shuffle, and a block transfer. It was a very sophisticated expert technique that Vernon was expert with, that Doc Daly was expert with. That's the way John Thompson did the trick. And if you want to see the real way that Vernon did the trick, you look at John Thompson on the L&L videos, or you can read it if you're lucky enough to own a copy of my book, The Magic of Johnny Thompson. It was done with this expert technique, but then Vernon created that ingenious version of a push-through shuffle with a simplified single card block transfer that's in The Stars of Magic, and all of a sudden everybody can do this very advanced trick. Now, those weren't his only contributions, but that was a significant area of his contribution in terms of simplifying magic and making it practical and keeping it deceptive. In other areas, however, he contributed very sophisticated technique, very advanced techniques, like his double lips and other techniques that move things along, his improvement, his refinement, I should say, of the diagonal palm shift, his development of the topping the deck from his booklet Select Secrets, which is, while inspired by a sentence, a single sentence in Erdnase, is vastly superior and refined beyond the Erdnase method in the creation of the Vernon palm, or the better known as the topping the deck palm, which I believe is the single most elegant card sleight in all of card magic. And I realize that's a very bold statement to make. But it is a spectacular sleight, a sleight that I teach to every single one of my students. And it takes students who are not advanced quite a while to learn it, but they can learn it if they're taught it properly. And now they have a sleight that's absolutely spectacular. So yes, he did that. He refined and engineered sleights. He gave us these great plots like Triumph and The Travelers, which is a walking, talking lesson in misdirection, and one of his greatest tricks, one of my favorite tricks. And so he did that too. Then he also gave us these standardized, these routines that are so great in their conception that they become the standard handlings of ancient routines like the cups and balls and the linking rings. And they become the standard handlings for many, many reasons. And on my instructional video about cups and balls, I go into great depth about my theories behind why Vernon's routine became the standard. And it has a lot to do with issues of clarity of effect, which was a big, big issue with Vernon that he always talked about. Always said, confusion is not magic. But we're not done there, because then he also greatly advanced two areas of magic, of card magic, that were of great interest to him. One is the think-a-card plot, a plot that goes back to the first earliest written descriptions of magic. There's a think-a-card plot about watching the gaze of the spectator as a method that's in The Discovery of Witchcraft, written in 1584, and addressed in many other books since then. Vernon was fascinated with that plot, but he took us wildly beyond it. He invented Out of Sight, Out of Mind, which is like a postgraduate course in how to do the think-a-card plot under the most fairest of conditions, where a card is thought of under the fairest of conditions and then found under the very interesting and mystifying conditions. And no less than Ryan Plunkett, a young worker and a real worker, from Chicago, who works at Chicago Magic Lounge, included his version of Out of Sight, Out of Mind in his recent book. It's absolutely terrific. Really interesting take on it that has to do with the conditions that Ryan works under. But then also Vernon was fascinated. If you read the first volume of the Vernon biography as written by David Benn, you can learn of how Vernon first became interested in the idea of multiple outs. Well, he took the idea of multiple outs that many magicians just take for granted, and he turned it into one of the greatest tricks and conceptions in the history of card magic, which is a trick that cannot be explained. A trick that on the one hand is done by true experts, it's also done by great mentalists, and is also was done, was a favorite plot of Eugene Berger. So all of these roads lead to Di Vernon. There's a reason that he had a generation of students, of acolytes, of proteges like Larry Jennings and Bruce Servant and Michael Skinner, one of the greatest sleight of hand artists I ever knew, and Johnny Thompson and Harry Reiser and Bob White. There's a reason that all of those performers were directly connected with Vernon and constantly cited Vernon in all of their work. And now that that generation has finally more or less left us with the loss of now of Johnny Thompson and most recently of Bob White, now, one of the reasons I'm out there talking and blogging and teaching and talking about Vernon is because it's up to that next generation to explain and keep alive those valuable lessons, not just out of the idea of, oh, we must respect our elders. That's abstract. And that's a nice idea, but who cares? What matters is the work. And, there are countless young magicians. Nobody does the cups of balls. It takes too long. It's too slow, blah, blah, blah. Oh, really? Well, Dennis Kyriakos is a working pro in San Francisco who does a version of the Vernon routine of cups and balls. Matt Holtzclaw is a top professional in New York, a key core of his repertoire, and a wonderful gig that was going in New York before COVID, a place called Speakeasy Magic, fantastic gig that I worked myself. Matt Holtzclaw, among other top workers in that room, closed his sets with a version of the Vernon cups and balls. And Noah Levine, who has a hit show in New York, Magic After Hours, that takes place at the Tannen's shop at nights, and I'm sure will come back soon, uses the cups and balls and an original take on the Vernon, a very original take on the Vernon routine. So it's not about just respecting the past for the abstract purposes of knowing history. That's important and it's invaluable. But we have to select what we spend time on and what are our sources and who are our mentors. And it's fine to add new books if you're careful. There's great new books coming out in magic all the time. I just mentioned I'm fond of Brian Plunkett's. I'm in the middle of reading John Carney's new book right now. Speaking of Vernon acolytes, another second generation, third generation Vernon acolyte like myself. But what are you going to spend time on? What are you going to learn from? What's going to help make you a great magician? The Vernon Book of Magic helped make me a great magician. So there you go.
Well, thank you. I think if there's anything that at least I take away from that is, I mean, first of all, I'm happy to put my hand up and say I didn't know half, if not three quarters, if not 9/10 of everything that you just said. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to learn, and I think it's really interesting, especially also just to it's fascinating what you said about like the double lift really got my attention, because as far as like moving magic forwards and like looking back with respect at the same time and learning from the best sources, it just made me think, like, I wonder what other moves you could perform more naturally, right? That would have the same effect as Di Vernon, like doing that double lift and fooling magicians.
Right. Well, that's the real question. I mean, that's, when we talk about naturalness being Vernon's mm-hmm. mantra, I can't, my students, I always have a handful of students all around the country and sometimes around the world. And the sentence they get tired of hearing me say, because there's hardly a session that goes by without me saying it somewhere along the line, I'm going to say, what's the real thing? Show me the real thing. If you haven't got perfect mastery of the real thing, how you cannot create a convincing, deceptive imitation of it. And yet I see constantly magicians who you can't, they don't have a real thing to imitate. And you can tell because the move's too contrived. You know, the purpose of a double lift is not to invent a way to hold two cards together as one that no one ever invented before, so you can put your name on it and put it on a penguin lecture. The purpose of the double lift is deceptively to turn two cards over as one. Well, we have a couple of really good methods for that. And frankly, if you're doing 10 different versions of that, the effect you're creating is that you may be mentally ill.
I love how your clock chimed at that exact moment as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really added
the
to
bell, the bell tolls for thee. because really, how many ways does a normal person turn over to the top card of the deck?
Right. Yeah. I mean, one. Yeah. I like that as well. That's actually something that I am mentored by magicians who are actually, like you say, like workers, and who they tell me very like similar things. Like, and it is really revolutionary. I hope people like actually listen to what Jamie just said. And if your move like isn't motivated naturally, then you should really like seriously think about whether or not you want to perform it. Like, there are definitely really fun moves, but at the same time, like, if you wouldn't actually do that, it doesn't make much sense to perform it in that way. And you can motivate it. Like, you can create a story around it that makes that move motivated. Yep. But yes, that's an important point.
That's right. In my second or third book, I think the third book, I have a whole chapter about Michael Skinner. And I include a couple of two little techniques that I learned from Michael. And one of them is a very contrived double lift that I would not normally recommend. But Michael devised that double lift for one specific application that had to do with a kind of ambitious card move, although he used it at more, I think, in a elevator routine, which is a tabled packet version of the ambitious plot, but where it made sense because you're kind of running your finger up the deck, and in a continuing action, you present the top card in this kind of flourishy way. And it's not so much whether the move is great or not, or whether you choose to use it, but the fact is he was very much a Vernon student and very attuned to naturalness, but he was willing to not make a rigid rule out of that if he had a good enough reason to do something differently. And, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, we have all these contrived procedures. You know, to have someone peek at a card is a very contrived procedure. We know this because we have to instruct them as to how to do it, right? We say to them, do me a favor with your left thumb, reach out and crack the deck here and take a peek at a card, right? We have to teach them how to do that in the moment. Which by the way, I think is vastly superior to the peak where they just call stop and the magician is doing the riffling. That was developed because it's much easier for the magician to do, but it's by no means better. It's obviously inferior. The whole point of the spectator peak is that it seems so incredibly fair that the magician can't have any control. And this is why it was used so extensively. Its earliest users were Leipzig and Mellini. But it's not that you can't use that. It's a question of, can you set it up in a way? Can you make sense of it? Can you discuss it in a way, briefly, that there's a reason for it? And then also, if you're going to have a card selected in a contrived way, whether it's by a peek or by a riffle or dribble stop, for example, like, you know, you dribble through the cards and have them say stop, well, then how are you going to control the card? It makes no sense. This is something John Carney's written about, among others. It makes no sense in a performance of, you know, three card tricks to have the card selected three different ways. Then they're selected one way, they're returned and controlled a different way. You're riffling, peeking, dribbling. You know, it's chaos and it's noise. And yet I'm not saying that any of those methods should not be used. I'm actually fond of all of those methods. But I try and create, Roberto Giobbe has written about this in Card College, I try and create an internal consistency. So at very least, And it was Ron Wall who first wrote an influential essay about this many, 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 many years ago. None of your readers will know about, but it was an Ibidem. But about the idea that if you have a card selected in a particular way, you should control it in the same way, in a consistent fashion. If they take the card from a spread, they should return it to a spread. If they take it from a dribble, they should return it in a dribble. And then maybe you control it to a dribble, right? They dribble stop to select the card, dribble stop to put it back. And that's the time, that is the time to do a dribble shift, right?
Right.
Now it all makes sense. And you get this internal kind of logic and consistency to your work.
Yeah, I love that. That's a really, really good tip. I hope people are listening are actually listening to that, because it is such a good tip. And
didn't have time to explain the Hooperizing cards.
Yeah, next time. We are running out of time next there. Time. Like, yeah. So I guess we'll have to close it up here.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's unfortunate, but maybe another time.
Yeah, bummer.
All right. Thank you so much, Jimmy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.